This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. When China's first emperor died in 210 BC, he was buried in an enormous mausoleum together with thousands of life-size clay figures of warriors and horses. The figures came to light in the 1970s. Farmers digging a well in 1974 came across a clay figure. On the program today, the story of China's first emperor and the Terracotta Army. Historian and travel writer John Mann is our guest. John Mann is the author of 9 books. The most recent are The Terracotta Army, China's First Emperor and the Birth of a Nation, and The Great Wall, the extraordinary story of China's wonder of the world. Mann's book, The Great Wall, also involves the first emperor. As king of the state of Qin, he was the first ruler to unite China, and he was the first to defend it with a wall. Mann says that some accord the date of the first emperor's accession as the most important in China's history. Mao looked to the first emperor as a model. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guest. I look forward to your phone calls. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free number, that number, 800-222-9455. John Mann, so good to talk with you today.
I'm glad to be with you.
At the close of the preface to the Terracotta Army, you say, the army, like the Great Wall, states two grand themes of China's history, geographical unity and continuity. Did these two themes also play out in the pageantry of the games we saw in Beijing this summer?
Well, I'm afraid to say I was in Mongolia at the time, and I entirely missed it. So I'm only going by hearsay, but the answer is yes, I believe it did. The pageantry was certainly meant to emphasize the unity of China, as was all the security arrangements beforehand. Mm-hmm. And I think there was even a mention of the Terracotta Army. Of course, this is something which is quite recent because it was Mao himself who brought the first emperor back into fashion, as it were. He was persona non grata for quite a long time because of the extremely harsh nature of his rule. But that was something that Mao actually admired. He had to have strength in order to impose unity.
Yeah. In your words, I believe the in this comes from the Great Wall. You say the army escaped its original purpose as defense against malign spirits and has come to stand for the nation past and present, thanks to Mao.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, it's a very strange circumstance, but they came to light in the 1970s, and that was when there was a big power struggle going on between Mao and his rivals, and he asserted in no uncertain terms the importance both of unity and of force in order to assert that unity, and the first emperor, therefore, was an extremely good model.
Mm. Well, tell us the story of the farmers who made the discovery.
Yes, well, if you go to the Terracotta Army today, you can still see surrounding them orchards and some old houses, the remains of what that little town of Lintong used to be like. It's not like that anymore, of course, but still you can get an idea of it. And there are farmers still in the surrounding area. There always had been. Persimmon trees, other sorts of fruit trees, and rather scrubby barley fields, wheat fields, and that sort of thing. And there was a drought that year in 1974, and a family of farmers, 6 brothers, had decided to dig a well. As they dug deeper, they came across the torso and then the head of a statue. And they were, unfortunately, to say, appalled by what they discovered, because it was extremely bad luck to discover something like this in a place where the dead came from. And so they tossed away the head, they tossed away the torso, and went on digging. And by entire good chance. There was a local archaeologist heard of what was going on and went up to see them and took away some of their finds and preserved them. And then, by a second good chance, a journalist from Beijing came along, heard about the find, and wrote it up in Beijing for the government. Mm. And it was at this point that it came to the attention of the authorities and Mao himself. And so the order went down that whatever had been found should be preserved, and there should be an archaeological dig to find out what was under there. And it was only at that point that people discovered that there was this immense treasure trove, perhaps the most significant archaeological find in Chinese history.
Yeah. Now, apparently there had been similar discoveries going back to the 1940s, but without this cast of characters coming together, including the journalist and the fellow at the museum, that's why those discoveries didn't cause a stir.
Yes, nobody knew what they were. They were just the occasional finds. In fact, three figures are still there in the Lintong Museum, which had been found before. But nobody had any context to put them together. Nobody knew that there was a big find still to be made. Some people began wondered whether they were, in fact, Qin, 2,000 years old. But there was nothing else to go on. There were no tiles had been found, no other discoveries which would enable them to be properly dated. So they were just mysterious figures.
Yeah. And the farmers who uncovered the pieces of this what one of them called an earth god.
Yes. Yang Jifa, his name was.
How did their lives change as a result of this? Did their lives change?
It actually changed their lives completely and totally. And four of them are still there today in their 80s, signing books which are put out about the Terracotta Army. So it has become their life ever since. They were, I have to say, entirely unprepared in any way for this huge discovery and for the publicity that followed. So they have to do the publicity, and it is their income, but they're not great publicists and try to avoid the camera. They're very camera shy and still simple peasants at heart.
Yeah. You have a photo of one of them in the book.
Yes.
Yeah.
He says no photos in the sign in front of him and tries to hide himself from camera flashes with his fan.
Yeah. Well, what kind of work is being done on the site today?
As far as I could see, nothing at all. At the moment, I mean, there are huge plans which are hardly formulated because they're so enormous. Because to reveal these statues is to risk destroying them. They about 1,000 have been put together now, and because of the conditions in which greeted them in the vast hall where they stand, they tend to grow a sort of a mold. There's a slight fungus problem in pit number one, which is a huge hangar, really. At the time, in the 1970s, it was quite an architectural feat to build an arch over this pit, which is, 220 yards long and about 70 or 80 wide. But there's no air conditioning. And until the conditions are better, they will not be revealing any more of the statues. And there must be another 6,500, perhaps 7,000 statues still to be unearthed. Mm. So the ones that you see are the ones that you'll get for quite a long time to come. When I was there, the last of the peasant farmers, the villagers, had been moved out of an area round about the tomb, the tomb being separate from the Terracotta Army. The army guards the tomb, and the tomb is as yet untouched. It's an enormous thing, about 150 meters high and roughly the size of the Great Pyramid, but unopened as yet. In perhaps, I don't know, decades to come, there will be an enormous park there and something which will be far more superb than the present one, with numerous other pits linked, I'm sure, by footpaths and with their own their own introductory buildings and no doubt which will all be air-conditioned. Mm. So there's a lot more still to come there.
Yeah. Are there plans to go into the tomb in the near future?
No plans that I know of, and I think it would be extremely difficult because of the depth of soil, firstly, and secondly, to preserve what's in there will be a tremendous feat of archaeology and architecture. There is a legend that the first emperor is in there, buried somehow or other in a cask of mercury, and that there is that there are the rivers of the empire sketched out in mercury, of all things. So it would be quite dangerous if that is true. And indeed, there have been probes in the surface which reveal the presence of mercury vapor. So whoever goes in there will have to take some precautions. Mm. And of course, to reveal what's in there to the air would be to destroy it. And I think the only way to do it would be to cover the whole tomb with some sort of vast millennium dome and air-condition the whole thing. I know it would be a stupendous operation.
Yeah, well, the Chinese are no doubt up to it, I would imagine.
Oh, I think so, yeah. Yes. And I suggest at the end of the book that maybe it would be a fine birthday present as to commemorate the revolution in 2049, if they could open such a thing. But there are no plans at the moment, detailed plans.
So there are tremendous challenges of decay and preservation, and then there's also issues surrounding, you know, restoration.
Yes. They are, because every statue so far found has been smashed. What happened was that the pit was covered with enormous beams, if you can imagine, things the size bigger than telegraph poles, about 6,000 of them. And they caught fire in circumstances I can tell you all about, if you like, later on. And they all collapsed and broke all the statues when they fell, and the earth fell in above, and water washed earth in above that, and so that gradually the whole thing was lost, all memory of it was lost, and it vanished for 2,000 years.
Mm. Amazing. Now, there's an exhibit of the Terracotta Army in the United States, and it's going to travel to 4 cities remaining in the U.S. until the end of March 2010. The closest it will be to us will be in Atlanta, Georgia, from November 16th of this year, 2008, to April 26th of 2009. Have you seen this exhibit, and what can you tell us about it?
Well, I've seen the statues because they were in London for 6 or 7 months. Hmm. A show which ended in March, I think, this year. And yes, I saw that. It's what's wonderful about it, and I'm sure the same thing applies in the for the American show, is that you can get up close to these soldiers. In Xi'an, in Lintong, the pit is enormous, and it's a very dramatic view. But you are kept above them and a fair distance away. Only very special people, like the Clintons, actually, were allowed in amongst them, and the archaeologists, of course. But when you see them in the show, you can get very close to them and get a very good feel for them, a far better feel in some ways, because you can see them as complete individuals, and everyone is different.
That's a fascinating part of the story as well. They are individuals. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about how this army was created.
Well, they are created in a way as an idealized view of the first emperor's army. All his soldiers were, of course, individuals and different. And so the idea was that I think that every one of these should be different. And this is actually dictated by the way they were made, because they were made in molds, and all the items on their faces, like the hair, the eyebrows, the ears, the noses, the beards, are all created in different molds. And there are half a dozen different forms of all these molds, so that they can be combined in, a huge number of different ways. And so that no two as far as we can tell, are the same. It would be a strange coincidence if they were. But they're not individual portraits. They're designed to display individuality without being portraits of actual soldiers. And they are idealized because they're all wonderful-looking. They all have this serene expression. They're all roughly the same height, at least the soldiers are. The officers are a little bit taller, and there are a few generals who are even taller still. But you have none of the individuality of a normal army, where people have wounds on their faces or have distorted limbs or of many different sizes and shapes.
Why are they idealized then? What, maybe you would talk with us a little bit about what were the beliefs about what this army was going to do, this clay army?
Well, it's idealized because it's idealized also in another way, I should point out, that we're used to seeing them as gray figures, terracotta, in fact. But that's a function of them, of what happened when they were unburied, when they were taken out of the earth. Originally, they had the most stupendous colors. The skins, the uniforms were all a huge array of bright colors, reds, purples, blues, and greens. And, of course, this was not realistic at all. Originally, the army had lamellar plate armor of leather, and there was no way that it would have been colored in that way, which is an incredibly expensive process, in fact, probably more expensive than actually making them in the first place. It reflected what their real aim was, which was to protect the emperor in the afterlife. They're a spirit army, and they all face east, which is where the emperor's main challenges came from when he was uniting China. And presumably in the afterlife would reflect this life, and he would be the purpose would be the same, namely to that he would recreate his empire in the afterlife, and he would need his army to do that, to fight off spirit armies. Now, all of this is conjecture. Nobody wrote a theological report on the emperor's beliefs. But there are other things about the finds that have been made which seem to support it. For instance, there's one pit, entirely separate, which was full of a stone armor. I mean, the most beautiful stone armor, with tiny little scales, made of scales, of limestone, held together with bronze wire. And, of course, entirely impractical in any sense, because if you hit limestone with a club, for instance, it'll just smash. So the purpose of these some 200 suits of limestone armor is very mysterious, and the only explanation that anyone can come up with is that stone was regarded as a protection against spirits. And I mean, it boggles the imagination, but here you have a full-size army of maybe 7,000 or 8,000 warriors with full-size weapons, real weapons, crossbows and spears. And presumably when the time came, they were meant to, as a spirit army, go through the earth and maybe don these suits of armor, which were stored separately, in readiness for a battle of some sort with some sort of spirit army. That's, I think, pretty much the intention.
Historian and travel writer John Mann is our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He's the author, most recently, of The Terracotta Army, China's First Emperor and the Birth of a Nation, and The Great Wall, The Extraordinary Story of China's Wonder of the World. Both books are published by the DeCapo Press. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Early in The Terracotta Army, you tell readers that the first emperor was moody, easily angered, and unpredictable. So what kind of a ruler was he?
Well, I think probably he was both a genius and extremely ruthless. He had a pretty insecure youth, and I would imagine that very nearly it was pretty much down and out, and then brought in by a mentor who saw that if he could leave it onto the throne, this mentor, Liu Bowei, his name was, would be in a position of some authority, power, and wealth. And that's exactly what happened. So the emperor himself was a man who was given the chance to achieve power, achieved it, and then had to preserve it and extend it. And he did so by with the most ruthless methods that he could possibly employ. If you could imagine a Machiavelli type person in ancient China, using the most ruthless methods he could to keep control, to seize control, and then keep control of his, firstly of his army and of his government, and then of other seven nations which had to be defeated in order to unify China. It was an extraordinary achievement, which he did in only a decade. It was a decade of the most ruthless, vicious, and supremely successful conquest.
Yeah. Maybe here you would tell us a little bit about three figures who are very important: Lord Shang, Han Fei, and Li Zi.
Well, Lord Shang is the one who is perhaps best known in the West, and it was he who devised the philosophy of how to get power, and in particular keep power in China. And he is really the Machiavelli figure that I mentioned earlier. The methods are to use extreme force, never to allow anybody to achieve much power, much authority, and to make sure that there is no no contrary opinion expressed in your kingdom. This meant, in his case, supposedly burying scholars who were critical of him alive, and burning books, all books which were expressed views that might possibly be a threat to him. Now, this is a view which has come down to us, but it was written about 100 years after he died, and there are some doubts as to whether, as to the accuracy of these reports, and whether he was quite as bad as he was painted. And the person who wrote the account of his career, Sima Qian, had an agenda, and the agenda was that he wished to be critical of his own emperor, but he couldn't be critical directly. So what he did was blow the first emperor out of all proportion and criticize him instead. So the stories are terrific, and I tell them, but one should always bear have a little skepticism that it was quite as bad as that. There was no need, for instance, to kill off all the scholars. And indeed, they weren't all killed, because there's a mention of other advisors who apparently survived this particular Holocaust. And there is scholars just simply doubt that we need regard him as quite as bad as he was.
Mm. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, John Mann. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Toll free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let's take a call now from a listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hello.
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 Hello, sorry. I was in Dion in June and saw and was at the Terracotta Warrior place. And it is just, you just cannot believe how big it is and how many figures there are. And it's just wonderful.
It is wonderful. It's a wonderful sight. And you see them from the platform in the front there wander around them. And it's hard to believe that there are another six times that many still to be discovered.
Oh, that's amazing. Huh. We did see one of the farmers who had the little sign, no photos.
Yes.
I bought a book, which, of course, I had to do. And
yes.
Find it. And it was just a really neat experience.
Yes, what was the temperature like inside? June should have been okay, but it can get terribly hot.
It was okay. It was cool. I didn't realize that it wasn't air conditioning because it didn't feel really hot, although in the sunlight it was very hot outside.
Yes, it acts as a greenhouse, and it can be pretty oppressive inside.
I would imagine. So, but I'm interested in looking at your book.
Good.
So, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other calls are invited, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, what had China been like before the first emperor?
Chaos, anarchy, I think is how you describe it in geopolitical terms. There were at least seven, and actually considerably more, seven big states and a lot of little ones. So it was rather like Europe in the early Middle Ages, with a lot of petty princes, every one of them striving to increase their power and their land and their influence. But it was also an extremely stimulating time, because although there was war, there was also a great desire, naturally enough, for peace. And there was a tremendous inspiration for those philosophers and intellectuals to try to devise ways to live well and preserve peace. And this is that was the sort of stimulus that produced the philosophies of, for instance, Confucius and Lao Tzu, and also a great emphasis on diplomacy, so that as well as being at war with each other, there were also drives for peace. There were peace missions. Diplomacy was at a pretty high level. Intellectual achievement was at a pretty high level as well. So anarchy, but also a great intellectual stimulation.
Yeah. So as you say, while there was an obsession with war, there was also obsessions with peace and in diplomacy.
Yes, I think we know we've seen a little bit of that in the Cold War here, where governments will talk war to each other, but at the same time will indulge in great efforts to keep the peace.
Hmm. And you also quote in the book the author of The Art of War.
Yes.
And there are
Sun Tzu,
again parallels.
There are indeed. Of course, he was concerned about leadership and strategy, but that was another of the products of the Warring States, as they were called.
Had others tried to pull together China's regions and peoples before the first emperor?
There's a unity of culture in China. Of course, then it wasn't the sort of unity that we have now. But nevertheless, there were wandering scholars, there were scripts, there were bureaucracies which shared ideas. So although political unity was not really on the cards, there was an idea of unity, of what could be achieved if only that peace could be imposed. And it was that the first emperor really succeeded more than anybody else had before. If you look at a historical map of China from before that and played it in fast motion, it would look like like molecules under a microscope, continually forming and reforming larger and smaller units. And it was only the first emperor who managed to establish some sort of stability. I mean, it was done at a great cost, but nevertheless, it was a great achievement. And of course, that was the achievement to which Mao looked back.
Mm. What was his plan for conquering the areas outside his home region, his home state, Qin?
There are no details. Mm. As I say, the history was only written 100 years after the event. But something can be gleaned from the army itself, from the Terracotta army itself, from the crossbows, which were extremely powerful and effective weapons. There were repeating crossbows, which would act as sort of machine guns. And the crossbow triggers are masterpieces of ingenuity. And a lot of those, they're metal and extremely refined. And a number of those have been found in pit number one, so that we know how the crossbows worked extremely effectively. And then there were soldiers, a variety of ranks. There were lancers, ordinary archers, cavalry, and they would clearly have been deployed in a way which made them supremely effective. What those ways were, nobody knows for sure, but it was the army that was the basis of what he did, and naturally they were supremely church.
And I think we've just lost our guest, Jason Croft. I think we've lost our guest. Could you want to check on that, please? Jason Croft is our technical director here on the Afternoon Magazine. Suddenly we have a problem here this afternoon here on the program. John Mann, our guest this afternoon. He's the author of several books. The most recent are The Terracotta Army, China's First Emperor and the Birth of a Nation, and The Great Wall, the extraordinary story of China's wonder of the world. Both books are published by the DeCapo Press. And both of these books are available now, and they were available as the world watched the games this summer in the Olympic Games in Beijing. And there is also an exhibit that is traveling the United States, the Terracotta Army exhibit. It is the largest traveling exhibit of the Terracotta Army ever to visit the United States. It is currently in Santa Ana, California, and it will be there until October of this year, October 12th. Next, it will go to the High Museum of Art in Atlanta, Georgia, where it will be on display from November 16th, 2008, until April 26th, 2009. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Again, our guest this afternoon, historian and travel writer John Mann. And I think we've got him back on the phone.
Yeah, sorry about that.
I don't know what happened. But anyway, you were telling us about the crossbow. Did you want to finish?
I don't know how far I got before I got cut off, but I was talking about the effectiveness of the crossbow and the ingenuity of the crossbow release mechanism. And we know about that in detail because a number of the crossbow triggers were found in pit number one. So it's possible to reconstruct these, and they're very powerful and effective weapons. And to have a repeating crossbow firing five arrows at a time or one after the other, rather like a machine gun, was a pretty effective way of devastating the opposition.
Mm-hmm. Well, now we've talked about the sword, so to speak, maybe we should talk a little bit more in depth about the pen and books.
Aha, uh-huh. Yes. The book itself.
Yeah.
Yes, my interest was originally in Mongolia and then in the relationship between the nomads of the north and the settled cultures of the south and the interface between them, which produced the Great Wall. And I was writing got into the Great Wall, having gone the length of it and the breadth of it and become fascinated by that, when I heard that the Terracotta Army was coming to London. And at that point, my publisher said, go do the Terracotta Army at once. And so I was very happy to go off and do that. And as it turned out, there was a big overlap between the two books because it was the first emperor, as you said, who devised the idea of the first Great Wall in his lifetime, and then to defend himself after his death, the Terracotta Army. So the character of the emperor became extremely important to me, and those few years were extremely important in China as well. So it was a great privilege to be able to be involved with both projects.
Yeah, and here we're talking about two books, and at the time of the first emperor, books were also important. They were important to those in power, but they were also as you mentioned earlier, often burned. What can you tell us about the books of the period, and did the first emperor read? How did they work? Were their books included in his mausoleum?
Nobody knows whether there are books included in his tomb because it hasn't been opened. Mm-hmm. There are none that have been found in the pits of the Terracotta Army. Certainly, there was a hugely long cultural tradition in China, and of course, it had had writing for many, many centuries. Much more than that, from about 2000, seven centuries before the first emperor. So the traditions were extremely well established. The script was, you can follow through some of the script right to the present day, but the problem with ideographs like the Chinese use is that they're extremely variable, and the old script is hard to read now. There are scholars who read it, of course, but it varied between all seven states. So although all the major states had their scholars and their bureaucrats and their traditions of writing, the emperor, when he came, when he unified China, also unified the script. It was one of the things that he did in order to impose unity on the whole of central China. And after that, the traditions continued, of course. But many thousands of what we call books were in fact scrolls, as well as volumes. And there was paper. There was block printing as well. And so that China at the time was intellectually extremely advanced.
Hmm. How else did the first emperor assert his rule over such a huge empire, in addition to the adoption of a universal script?
Well, there were strange parallels with today. If you go in China, into the far outside Beijing, if you go west and south, you into remoter areas, you find new roads now. This is over the last 10 years, of course, and there's been a stupendous push in road building. This is long before there is the traffic to fill them. So the Chinese know that in order to develop and to control, you need infrastructure. And this is precisely what the first emperor did. He built a stupendous road system out of Xi'an, reaching to all corners of his new kingdom. There were roads, there were canals, there were big canal systems built. Of course, what happened was that as soon as unification was complete, a vast army was released, and they had to be kept employed. So there was, for the first time in Chinese history, huge labor force, which was very well employed on these great projects. And one of the projects, of course, was his own tomb and his palaces as well. So there was a tremendous political motivation to undertake huge projects in every respect.
Great public works projects, then, in addition to his projects to satisfy his own vanity.
Yes.
Yeah.
I suppose you would call it his vanity, but in the belief system at the time, it would presumably have been merely self-preservation to undertake these projects and build a tomb such as others. Well, nobody had built a tomb quite like this before, but there were quite a few afterwards. I mean, this is what emperors did, and they also, in subsequent emperors as well, built walls or strengthened the wall or bits of walls. This became a function of the business of being an emperor, that you would undertake a vast project like the wall in order to keep your peasants and armies employed and show that you were taking a strong stand against the barbarians of the north. Now, the barbarians of the north, the Mongols, the Xiongnu, as they were called, the Huns, as we call them, and then subsequently Turks and Mongols, were never quite the threat that the Chinese like to think of them as. Their main interest was in not so much in, certainly not in conquest, but not so much in raiding, but is in trading, because in order to get those goods which were not available north of the Gobi Desert. And it was the Chinese continually objected to trade because it seemed demeaning. Yet they also needed it. So there was this strange, paradoxical, schizophrenic approach to the problem of the northern border, which produced the wall and did so for the next 2,000 years.
Yeah. Now, you went, you traveled the length of the wall, and tell us about the part of the wall that you came to, which was part of the first emperor's wall.
Well, north, the first emperor was in Xi'an, quite close to a semi-desert area called Ordos, where the Yellow River takes a huge swing to the north. This territory was strategically of great significance, and one of his first jobs on becoming emperor was to clear it of nomadic tribes and then build a wall along the top of it. I should say that the first wall that he built was not necessarily, certainly not the wall that we see today, and it was not probably, it's not a single entity that he created. He joined up a lot of previous walls. The Chinese had always built walls for their cities and then their states. So although it's presented as a sort of a unitary achievement, it was more a matter of joining up what was there before. But there was a new, what seems to have been a new bit, north of the Yellow River in the mountains there. When I went to see it, I discovered that some of it has been restored. And rather amazingly, it's not at all like the sort of wall we're used to seeing, the vast stone structure. In fact, this is slabs of slate and stone, and the whole thing is only about 5 or 6 feet high, and it's flat along the top. Beautifully built, a dry stone wall, runs for about 10 kilometers. But what struck me as extremely odd is that it doesn't seem to be much of a defensive wall.
Yeah.
I think it's more of a border wall. It's a wall which says, thus far and no further to you lot the other side. And I think I can imagine people patrolling on this side of it, but they wouldn't have had much of a chance of withstanding an attack, because there are places where a horse could get over it, and certainly foot soldiers could climb on top of it, and it wouldn't take a huge effort to take it. And so I think we're thinking less of a wonderful defensive structure than a statement of a border.
Mm-hmm. This is where we begin, or this is where you end. And so don't come across.
Yes.
But the funny thing is, though, with, you know, even if you were short of stature, you could, you know, with a leg up, you'd be over in, you know.
Well, yes.
In
there were. It was chosen. It ran along the side of a hill, so that the lower side was rather higher than the upper side. But even so, compared to what was done in the Ming dynasty a couple of thousand years, 1,500 years later, it's nothing very much. And it was very instructive to me to see it.
Hmm. To close, is there anything you would like to say this afternoon? We're here at the end of the time we can spend together.
Well, it's gone very quickly. What could I say about the go see the Terracotta Army if you possibly can, because it's you'll never have a better chance to get up close to them. There's a lot more to that show, actually, than the soldiers, than the warriors themselves. And there is one crossbowman who's been painted up in all his finery. And this is something that's only quite recently been discovered, the nature of the coloring. And that's particularly instructive.
Okay, very good. And then, in addition to seeing the exhibit, read the books, The Terracotta Army and the Great Wall.
Oh, that would make me very happy.
John Mann, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Well, I'm delighted to be with you. Thank you.
John Mann is a historian and a travel writer. He's the author of 9 books. The most recent are The Terracotta Army and The Great Wall. Both books are published by DeCapo Press.